All right, it's running.
Okay. Well, I'm facilitating today. I'm Andrew. Let me just very briefly review the rules. If you leave the class early, send an IM at the bottom of your screen there. If you do not wish to be recorded, then before each time that you speak, mention that you do not wish to be recorded. If you happen to be dropped from the call, do not call the group. That's like the most important thing. Wait to be called. Mute yourself when you are not speaking. When you are finished speaking, say over. And we will take, as before, people who haven't spoken in preference to those who have spoken. Okay, so I would like to turn first question, and I will read it, and then we can get a speaker's list. I do have Torov's answers to the questions, and if I can, some of them are a bit long, but if I can, and I can remember, I will read them, at least a few of them. He's got an answer to every question, which is good. Okay, the first question reads, Principles of Political Economy and Taxation by David Ricardo begins with distribution among classes. Quote, the produce of the earth is divided among three classes of the community, namely the proprietor of the land, the owner of the stock or capital, and the laborers. Capital, a critique of political economy by Marx, ends with distribution and classes. Is this difference significant? Why or why not? Hint. See the start of Marx's essay on alienated labor. Okay, who would like to speak?
Oh, I'll go first. Johnny?
Okay, I hear Shane. Does anyone want to follow Shane? Okay, take it away, Shane.
Yeah, the division into the different factors of production, you know, standard political economy, and Marx's basic point is that the way things are distributed is that, you know, is related to the means of production. It's an outcome of production, so to talk about how the distribution occurs is to assume what you need to prove. So politically, he says, political economy starts with the fact of private property. It doesn't explain it. So my short answer was that, you know, you need to understand those laws of production in order to understand how the distribution occurs, and that's linked to private property, as he says in the alienated labor essay. And so we're assuming what we need to prove rather than starting with distribution. We need to start with production. Over.
Would anybody else like to get in?
This is Brendan.
Take it away, Brendan.
Just briefly, Marx complains that treatises on political economy often start with an attempt to produce sort of generic, abstract categories that apply across historical periods, but in reality, what they often are doing is that they're taking capitalist categories and projecting them back in time. And so, his attempt to to flip this on he's trying to redress this problem as well by putting the putting categories, I guess, in their proper place where the historically specific things are treated thus and not treated as sort of, you know, general ahistorical categories. Over.
Okay, I'll be Thoreau's answer for this one. Yeah, go ahead.
It's Anne.
Yes, go ahead, Anne.
Whenever you want. Oh, all right. Yes, to what the other said. Others said distribution follows from the mode of production. the straight line of causality, he's also interested in the fact, as he says, they're opposite sides of the same coin. And that's important because they share the same historically transitory character. And this, if everyone's using the penguin, it's on 1018, where he goes into that. It's the second page of the chapter. How all of this is historical and transitory, and they'll rise and fall together. And I found it very interesting that Marx doesn't even mention class until the end of Capital, because classes, of course, arise also from the mode of production and are not a beginning point, but are an end point of that development. And I've been in some Capital classes, reading groups of classes where people were very dismayed because they wanted to explicate the text using the word class. But I think it's important to see that it's a result and not a cause as well. And I won't read this because I'm taking too long, but in the chapter 48 of volume 3, The Trinity Formula, there's a very beautiful paragraph that starts, "Vulgar economics actually does nothing more than interpret, systematize, and turn into apologetics the notion of agents trapped within bourgeois relations of production." And that has the famous expression about the form of appearance hiding what's really going on. And if everything were clear on the surface, we wouldn't need science. But it's not. So it's a very dialectical formulation as well. Over.
Okay, I'll call myself, and just to add to what's been said, let's get to something that Shane mentioned, and I want to come back to and kind of stress, is the primacy of production relative to everything else here concerning distribution in particular. Marx is concerned with the active relationship, and he says, you know, the worker produces her own poverty. The worker produces this, the worker produces that. His standpoint is that these categories of distribution and the division of society into these classes and the remuneration of the classes, you know, rent to the landowner, interest and profit to the capitalist, wages to the worker, all of this flows from the active relationship. And I think this is one of the major things that Marx sets out to show. In fact, you know, he finally gets around to it in the book Capital, is showing how its distribution does emerge from the relations of production. I think the point here is that if you want to be critical of the relations of production, you have to also interrogate, be critical of, and be aware of what gives rise to them. I won't say over because I have to see if anybody else wants to get in on this question.
I'll say something.
This is
Brian.
Go ahead, Brian.
I think, kind of to tie together some of the different things people have said, I think that there's just a huge methodological issue in the way that Ricardo and other people who have a similar attitude to him approach distribution. As was mentioned, it tends to eternalize categories. It doesn't explain how development occurs. And when this happens, you also turn away from production, which, as we said, was the main thing. And if we don't change the way we live, I don't think we can have a new society. Just distributing the results of how we live isn't going to change that. So I think people who turn to distribution in this manner and try to make it primary aren't capable of conceptualizing a new society because they're not actually getting to the heart of the issue. Over.
Andrew Paul here.
Okay, right before Paul, Brian, I didn't hear your last sentence. I heard the over. Could you repeat your last sentence, please?
I said that people who focus on distribution in this type of manner aren't able to conceptualize a new society because they're not getting to the heart of the issue. Over.
Thank you. Paul.
Yes, I just wanted to point out you steered us in the direction of the 1844 manuscripts. I also remembered the passage from the German Ideology where Marx says, and I'm just reading the text from an online version right now, where Marx says, men can be distinguished from animals by consciousness, by religion, or anything else you like. They themselves begin to distinguish themselves from animals as soon as they begin to produce their means of subsistence, a step which is conditioned by their physical organization. By producing their means of subsistence, men are indirectly producing their actual material life. Over.
Okay. Well, I think it's a good time to move to the second question, which kind of continues from the first question. So I'll read it and then see who would like to discuss this issue.
Excuse me, can I just ask Will to try the people who aren't here again? Because someone said they'd be late. And
I've been trying them, man.
Okay. Keep trying them a few more times. Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to read the second question. It reads, how does the, quote, customary view of distribution differ from the, quote, more developed and critical awareness, close quote? These phrases are in the first two pages of chapter 51 of volume 3 of Capital. What are Marx's criticisms of the latter, that is, say, the more developed and critical awareness? Okay, who would like to address this question?
This is Stephanie. If nobody else will, all I'm going to do is just say really what's on the paper. So if somebody has something more creative and in-depth, I'll pass. But otherwise, I can just read it.
Go ahead, Stephanie.
Okay, so where was I? Whoops, sorry. Okay, so on what I have, anyway, I'm not on the same page as other. I mean, I'm on the same page, but it's probably called something different because I probably went to a different site. But he says, a more advanced, more critical mind, however, admits the historically developed character of distribution relations, but nevertheless clings all the more tenaciously to the unchanging character of production relations themselves, arising from human nature, and thus independent of all historical development. And that relates to I'm going to just briefly back to the question number one in terms of how I answered it, because it was very brief and sketchy. But I felt that because Marx is a historical materialist, that he viewed the whole system of bourgeois economics starting with the social production of human life, and it was about social... he was talking about the mechanisms scientifically in a material way, but they were... These are material mechanisms which create the capitalist system of classes and distribution. Over. I hope that's coherent.
Andrew, this is Ravi. I'd like to come in at some point, please.
Okay, thanks, Stephanie. Go ahead, Ravi.
Well, there seems to be two things that hold together Marx's approach to this, which is historical specificity, which people have touched on, and the thing that Anne mentioned about totality, which is looking at the system of production and distribution as a unity, with production being primary, that gives rise to the distribution forms. But it does seem that on the thing on Estrange Labour, that even though Anne was talking about the fact that Marx doesn't mention classes until the very end of Volume 3 of Capital, but if you look at that discussion on Estrange Labour, which was in, I think it was the preface to the Critique of Political Economy, our contribution to the Critique of Political Economy, he was saying there that it's the separation of the worker's activity from himself and its alienated character that gives rise to all of this, and that is assuming a class society. And so it's quite important to see that we're not talking about something that's historically separated, but for the logical purposes of demonstration, that he kind of says he leaves classes till the end, because it's not, and it's a mistake that people sometimes make, which is that these are historically separated in time, whereas obviously they are a unity that all emerge together, and it's more to do with how you elucidate that for someone to be able to understand it. Is the structure of how he presents it in Capital. Over.
Okay, anybody else?
Andrew, this is Seth. Can I ask a question?
Go ahead, Seth.
Well, I'm just wondering where Ricardo fits into all of this. I mean, I haven't really read Ricardo, so I'm curious if he would be like Mill, one who Marx would describe as being, you know, more having a more developed and critical awareness. In the sense that, I mean, we discussed Ricardo treating the mode of production as eternal and not transhistorical and not as eternal, but is his view of the relations of distribution, does he see those then as historical and transitory? I mean, I know that he begins the principles of political economy and taxation with making the point that political economy has to begin from the laws that, I guess he uses the word regulate distribution. Over.
Okay, so Seth has a question on the floor. It's certainly germane, so that can be addressed. Also, question two directly can be addressed. I want to call on myself. I want to address question two. At the very end of chapter 51, Marx returns to this issue of what is this more developed and critical awareness all about. This is the last paragraph, and he says, The view that considers only the relations of distribution to be historical and not the relations of production is simply the perspective of a criticism of bourgeois economics that is incipient, but still timid and restrained. So he's tying it there into a certain kind of political perspective. But then he says something quite different as well. He says it is also based, however, this more developed critical awareness, as he called it, it is also based, however, on a confusion and identification of the social production process with the simple labor process, as this would have to be performed by an abnormally isolated person without any social aid. In other words, Robinson Crusoe. Insofar as the labor process is a simple process between man and nature, its simple elements remain common to all social forms of its development. But each particular historical form of this process further develops the material foundations and social form. Okay, so he's saying that, yeah, there is something in common between all production, and so if we just want to look at those commonalities, that would lead us to the idea of both of the views that he's criticizing, that production is basically immutable, ahistorical, and so forth. But then he continues, once a certain level of maturity is attained, the particular historical form is shed and makes way for a higher form. The sign that the moment of such a crisis has arrived is that the contradiction and antithesis between, on the one hand, the relations of distribution, blah, 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 blah. So then he's going into things that we'll be talking about in question. Question four. So I just thought it was interesting that he gives us both a political motivation to this more developed and critical awareness that, however, does not call into question the relations of distribution. But he also says that there's just this taking for granted that production is simple, easily understood, and not different among society. It's only a question of how you divvy the stuff up. That's differentiates one society from another according to that conception. Okay, who else would like to address this question or the question that Seth has posed?
Regarding Seth's question, the footnote on the page is who has this a slightly more sophisticated view is John Stuart Mill. I assume that's Marx's footnote. But I don't know enough about him to say what Marx is referring to, but I think it's it's very interesting, that stupid thing to say, but I hadn't previously noticed this distinction between those who absolutely say that both production and distribution are immutable and ahistorical, which, you know, has got to be your very, very standard classical economists, and the people who, or freed them, and the people who try to make a distinction, well, we can change distribution, you know, a little bit, but but production's production. It brings to mind, of course, and I think Stephanie or somebody said this, you know, brings to mind the redistribution advocates of our day who think that, inequality, if not poverty, can be solved by redistributing the products of labor. So it's a very important point, and I'm glad we're getting into it. That's all. Over.
This is Stephanie. I just want to say that I think Brian was the one who said that. Maybe I said it, but I'm not sure anymore because I'm looking ahead to the other question as well. So sorry about that, but I think it was Brian who brought that point up.
Okay. Sorry, Brian. Both smart cookies.
Thank you.
Okay, I want to sort of give a really rough historical sketch to try to put a little bit of this in perspective. People like Adam Smith and David Ricardo probably would not endorse Marx's description of what they're saying. What they would probably say is, well, of course, you could change distribution, you know, and of course you could change production as well, but you're just going to screw things up. And what we have, you know, is under present society is what is really, as they would still call it, natural. These are the natural relations of production and distribution. And what we had in prior societies, such as feudalism, were customary or state or whatever intrusions which hindered this development of the system of natural liberty, which is how they understood capitalism. The root of all of this actually is in feudal society, where it was very clear what the classes were. And you were born into a class, and you died in that class, and, you know, your kids became the members of that class, and so forth and so on. And this was viewed as just, and it was viewed as natural. And distribution then became understood to be just and natural if it perpetuated the system. This was articulated by St. Thomas Aquinas, that the just price is the price of whatever is the price that keeps the people in their station in life. And in a more atheistic or you know, agnostic formulation, that became basically Adam Smith's view. So the idea of a natural price became very important. So, you know, the normal wage rate that allows the workers to perpetuate themselves, that's the natural price of labor. You know, there's a natural rate of interest on capital, and so forth. And, you know, various things can disturb that, but there is, it's a kind of an equilibrium notion. So that's, I think that's what David Ricardo subscribed to as well, but he doesn't kind of belabor these points, but it seems to me to basically be following Smith's conception as far as I can tell. Okay, would anybody else like to address the second question? Okay, let's move then to, let me see if Taroff has said anything that hasn't been said before. It's hard for me to tell quickly. I'm going to move to question three then. which reads in chapter 51, and in the Critique of the Gotha Program, Marx distinguishes between two senses of distribution. What are they, and how do they differ? Who would like to address this or anything that's come before?
Andrew, this is Paul. I'd like to say something about this.
Okay, go ahead, Paul.
It seems to me that the two senses of distribution that are being referred to are the standard usage in which we're talking about the distribution of the social product. And in fact, what Marx is calling our attention to is that even before being able to discuss that, what we need to do is to recognize that there's a prior distribution, and that, of course, is the distribution relating to the means of production. And for me, I'm fairly involved with this distinction as a distinction that isn't ordinarily made in our political and economic discourse. One way it shows up for me personally, I've spent a fair number of years teaching community college, and of course ever since the financial crisis that ostensibly began in 2008 and led to the so-called jobs crisis, there's been a mantra about how we need to prepare our students for the jobs of the 21st century. And I'm always telling my students in class that I don't want to prepare them to take the jobs of the 21st century. I want to prepare them for being able to try to figure out what jobs need to be done in the 21st century as a way of sort of raising the distinction between talking about distribution as a, presupposing a certain distribution of means of production as opposed to raising the issue about who gets to decide what with respect to how the means of production is supposed to work. Over.
Okay, anybody else? If you're thinking that the question has been sufficiently answered, I would agree, but let me try to complicate it a bit. Why does Marx harp on this difference? Why does he not choose to view this as a totality, so to speak, and say, well, it's all distribution? And let's discuss distribution as such. What is the relationship between these two senses of distribution? Would anybody like to address question three?
This is Brendan.
Yeah, go ahead, Brendan.
I don't know if I can answer all of those questions you threw out there, but the distribution of means of production have a certain determining role in the class structure of society, and then that speaks to, or that has another determining role in the way the social product has to be divided between classes in order to perpetuate that class structure. But Marx also acts, I think it's in the introduction to the Grundrisse, or where he's talking about the method of political economy, where he's asking, sort of going back and forth about distribution and consumption, production, and sort of how these interrelated parts and why production is still sort of the determining force, or the determining point of view for the proper method in political economy. And I believe his argument is that even though the distribution of means of production has a certain like historical has to be in like an historically prior distribution in order to have the capitalist mode of production. That once capitalism is an established entity, an established mode of production, that mode of production recreates those relations of distribution of the means of production. So, in that sense, he's able to articulate with this. In that sense, he's able to still maintain production as the primary category for political economy, even though there is a necessity for, like, historically, that a certain distribution of means of production is important to have it exist before. I'm sorry, my I can't form my thoughts this quickly, but hopefully that was clear. Over.
This is Stephanie. I want to say something, but I'll wait because I've been talking a lot. So, but I thought what you just said was very coherent.
Torvald?
Go ahead, Torvald.
My connection has been holding, so let me try and speak. So I wanted to answer the extra question that Andrew raised. Why does Marx not only consider distribution? I think it's to do with the fact, I think it is a fact, that before we can eat, we must produce, or before we can consume or use anything, we must have it. And the must have it comes out of production, and that's the whole issue of temporalism, that production precedes consumption in time. Over.
Okay, anybody else on the question?
It's Stephanie again. If no one else has something to say, I just want to read briefly from the manuscripts.
Go ahead.
Okay. So the translation I have, anyway, it's kind of in the middle of the number of pages that I downloaded. It says the authority assumed by the capitalist as the personification of capital in the direct process of production, the social function performed by him in his capacity as manager and ruler of production, is essentially different from the authority exercised on the basis of production by means of slaves, serfs, etc. Whereas on the basis of capitalist production, the mass of direct producers is confronted by the social character of their production in the form of strictly regulating authority and a social mechanism of the labor process organized as a complete hierarchy. This authority reaching its bearers, however, only as the personification of the conditions of labor in contrast to labor, and not as political or theocratic rulers as under earlier modes of production. Among the bearers of this authority, the capitalists themselves, who confront one another only as commodity owners, there reigns complete anarchy within which the social interrelations of production assert themselves only as an overwhelming natural law in relation to individual free will. And I just kind of summarize that Marx was talking about like a historically determined positionality in a cyclical relationship versus the divine kind of static role that people held, or, that was divinely determined. Over.
Okay, so the passage that Stephanie was reading is in the middle of chapter 51 of Volume 3 of Capital, and it's on page, if you have the Penguin, page 1021. 2021. Okay. Would anybody else like to speak to this question?
Andrew, it's Ann.
Oh.
Yes. So Ann, and I heard another voice.
Peter Jones.
Okay, Peter Jones. So first Anne and then Peter Jones.
I don't know if you meant to discuss the lower phase of communism here. That's how I read the question, but maybe since you've taken it up later, you don't. But, you know, that's what I had gotten as one of the two discussions of distribution and the critique of the Gaza program.
Oh, this is Stephanie. I thought or Andrew did ask us about the lower phase of communism in question six. But over.
Yeah. But did you want something on it here, Andrew, or you don't care?
The question is open-ended.
All right, well, let me...
Address it however you wish.
Well, let me just say that, you know, he talks about how distribution is always a consequence of the conditions of production and the conditions of production, that is, who owns and controls the means of production, are not in the workers' hands, so that's absolutely ridiculous to think that there could be any kind of fair distribution. But before that, when he's discussing the lower phase of communism, he talks about, is that a fair means of distribution for that period of time in which we've broken with value production? People are working, and Marx says they should be measuring the time that they work, and they should get back from the products of labor equal an equal amount of time to produce as the time that they are putting into the society. And he says that's what really happens. And he says that, in, of course, in regard to the LaSallian program's stupid thing about, well, everyone's going to share equally and that's going to be equitable. He shows that the only possible way to distribute somewhat fairly at this early level of communism is to get back what you put into it in terms of hours, and to have a single standard, which is labor hours. And so that's a form of distribution. Over.
Okay. Peter, do you wish to be recorded?
Hi. No, I prefer not to. Sorry to be a pain.
Okay.
Yeah,
Will, can you shut off the recorder?
This is Dave Beach. I'd like to make a point.
Well, hello, Dave. first time I'm speaking to you. Go ahead.
I wonder whether there's a political point being made here, which is the difference between issues of distribution and then issues of the mode of production. So, Marx talks about how the claim for a fair day's pay for a fair day's work is like assuming that the wage relation, that wage labour can be made in favour of the worker, and he wants to abolish the wage relation altogether. So the idea of having a kind of dealing with the relationship between labour and capital through distribution just preserves that relationship. So distribution can't actually, as a political issue, can't ultimately affect the relationship, the class relationship that we're trying to address here.
Okay, thank you.
sorry, over.
Along with those lines and the lines of the previous comment at the end of that point three in the first section or part of the Critique of the Gotha program, Marx says, in fact, that the second sense of distribution, the common sense of distribution, distribution in that sense follows automatically from distribution in the former sense of the means of production. So he says it was a general mistake for the program to make a fuss about so-called distribution, the distribution, you know, of income or means of consumption, and put the principal stress on it. He says that's only a consequence of the distribution of the conditions of production themselves, which is a feature of the mode of production itself. The distribution of the means of making a living. That's the other distribution. He says the capitalist mode of production rests on the fact that the material conditions of production are in the hands of non-workers, property and capital and land, while the masses are only owners of their labor power, their ability to work. If the elements of production are so distributed, if one class is propertyless and the others own all the property, then the present-day distribution of the means of consumption results automatically. That is the strongest statement, I mean, the most bold and unadorned formulation that I've ever seen in Marx, reading Marx about this issue. It results automatically. If the material conditions of production are the cooperative property of the workers themselves, then there likewise results a distribution of the means of consumption different from the present one. I think that this definitely goes to the issue of politics. I mean, so many people are telling us, well, you know, we just have to, you know, take away from the 99%, take away from the 1%, get to the 99%, et cetera, raise wages, do this and that. The other view is that it's not going to work. I mean, it seems to me that what follows, whatever you might want to say, it's superficial and so forth, there's the issue, it's not going to work if indeed Marx is right that the present-day distribution is an automatic result of the distribution of the means of production, which is the distribution of the means of production basically means, you know, some people have no property, are not able to provide for themselves without doing the bidding of other people. Who else would like to address this question?
Shane here.
Yeah, go ahead, Shane.
This is all sort of caught up in the whole debate about economic determinism, I suppose, and I'd be inclined to read Marx as automatically there as a bit of a, you know, sort of follows logically from, you know, if you've got a class of people who own, you know, the means of production and the wealth producing capacity of the society and labourers who own nothing but their labour power, then it sort of follows, doesn't it, that what distribution you're going to get is a, you know, wealthy class at one end and a poor class at the other, you know, without sort of overreading it as a sort of automatic outcome, or without suggesting that distribution might be subject to class struggle and that class of wage labourers might not be able to improve their condition. He talks about that in Capital in terms of the corn laws and stuff, you know, that you can have a struggle and change the distribution, but broadly speaking, what you're going to get is a 1%, a 99%, you know, without sort of overreading you automatically, I think. Over.
anybody else on this question? Okay, why don't we move to the question? Peter Jones?
Yeah, just briefly, and again, sorry to be a pain. If you could shut off the recording, Will.
That, please, Stephanie.
Okay, so when I was when I was 3 years old was the first time I was called a communist, and this was by my mother. When I was 3 years old, we were renters still. We were renters for a very long time. And my dad used to come home from work. My mom was a housewife, a unpaid domestic worker in the family at the time. I was an only child at that time. And my dad used to come home from work and complain about money. I didn't really know what money was. I mean, I saw it exchanged. I knew there were poor people that were called poor people by this time, and I knew that there were people that were called rich people. And my dad would complain about bosses that were stupider than him and about people who made, and they were the bosses, who made more money than God. My parents did not raise me religiously, so I didn't know what God was. I didn't have a concept of God. However, I came up with this idea to try to make my father happier in life, and that was that grown-ups, when they went to work, instead of getting money, they should get a piece of paper that said they did their job. They would get the piece of paper. I don't know who was going to distribute the piece of paper, but they would bring it home or to the store, and I didn't know about banking yet, I guess, and investments, but they would bring that home and use it to get the stuff that they needed, like food and clothes and things. So I am just curious, you know, I mean, that was the first time I was called a communist, and my mom said it lovingly, but I think I asked her about it, and later in life that it resounded over. It's just an anecdote from my past.
Okay. Thank you. There's nobody else that want to move to question four? Okay, I'm going to move to question four, which reads, in the preface to his contribution to the Critique of Political Economy, Marx discusses the, quote, general conclusion, close quote, that, quote, became the guiding principle of his study, close quote. How does the distinction does the distinction between relations of production and relations of distribution tie into this? His general conclusion has been criticized for being economic determinant. What kind of politics or kinds of politics underlie and or flow from that criticism of economic determinism? And from the more developed and critical awareness that we talked about of the relation between production and distribution discussed above. Any take?
I'll come in on this, Andrew. It's Ravi.
Hey, Ravi, go ahead.
I think that this goes to the heart of the idea of freedom and what it's taken to mean under capitalism, because it does seem that the ability to see yourself as a free human being means that we are self-determined, and in some ways we're not compelled to do anything by circumstances. And it seems that the very idea of being deliberative individuals who are able to make choices in the world, it kind of goes against the idea that we are compelled by force of circumstance to do things against our will. And in that sense, it violates quite a central idea to the way our societies are set up, which is that everyone is free to make themselves what they want. And so by saying that the forms of our relationship to the means of production will limit our capacity to make choices, I think Marx is going against a very central kind of ideological component of how society is made up. Over.
Thank you. Anybody else?
Okay, Shane.
Yeah, go ahead, Shane.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, I'll just sort of tick the boxes for the basic sort of answer. And I think we, you know, if you get past, you know, Marxism 101, you know, anything I've ever learned about Marx always name-checked this, you know, university and at high school, it always sort of quotes this paragraph. I suppose it says in the reading 30 volumes, and it's all in this paragraph, you know, which indeed Marx sort of implies, I guess, by saying it's the guiding principle. But and it's always then said that Marx is an economic determinist, which is a strange thing, because I always think that bourgeois economists are economic determinists, and it's always the market that decides, and yet this charge is then leveled at Marx. But in a simple sort of answer, you know, you're saying that the relations of production, you know, constitute the economic basis of society, and the distribution is the legal and political superstructure. So I think that's the sort of the simple answer, that material relations of production are what makes the society up. I don't like the basic superstructure thing, but that's kind of the gist of the quote. And the distribution that we've been talking about is really part of the legal and political superstructure. So, I mean, in two senses, one, it provides a legal framework, so it says that, you know, the wage, yeah, you've got a contract, and the wage labourer is entitled to his wage, and the profit taker is entitled to their profit, and that's why you've got a legal system and the ideological system that says, well, this is a fair day's work for a fair day's pay, and that the capitalist is entitled to his return. And I don't think those factor returns, or, you know, the returns to land and labour and capital that we were talking about earlier, are just a product of Adam Smith and David Ricardo. It's how I learned economics in high school as well, that you know, there are factors of production, and each of those has its own return, and that's how the whole system is justified. So it isn't just a way of teaching that was common to classical political economy. It was how I learned economics 101. So I don't think Marx is an economic determinist. It's just a way of framing, you know, what he thinks is going on. And I think the terms of it being the politics, you know, as I said, is bourgeois politics, but the, you know, what this kind of model of the economics drives everything, you know, it washes out the history, which I think is what Peter said earlier too, that, you know, that these are matters of history, not just matters of economics. Over.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else?
Andrew, it's Paul.
Yeah, go ahead, Paul.
I can't resist, especially for those who are participating from the UK, I can't resist pointing out how interesting it is that this business about Marx and economic determinism is still sort of the view that permeates contemporary culture. And in the this weekend's Wall Street Journal, there's an excerpt from a new book called The Churchill Factor: How One Man Made History, which was apparently written by Boris Johnson, who's the current mayor of London. And I'm just reading a passage here which says, quote, "Churchill is the resounding human rebuttal to all Marxist historians who think history is the story of vast and impersonal economic forces," unquote. And of course, his point is, nah, history's made by people like Churchill, as if there were some kind of contradiction between the idea of human agency on the one hand, and it's being conditioned by the historical period and the mode of production in which we find ourselves. Anyway, I thought those of you, especially from the UK, would appreciate this. Over.
Okay, thank you. I do want to point out that the question did not ask whether Marx is or is not an economic determinant. One thing I want to say, although I agree with Shane about the distribution in the common sense of the distribution of income or whatever, it's largely a matter of legal relations. Marx does not, in the paragraph under discussion, refer specifically to distribution. But I think that there's another tie-in between how he conceives production and distribution and how he relates to all these other things, you know, legal, political, consciousness. He's concerned not only to get at the totality of the relations, but to understand the differences between them and what sets the ground for what, or what causes what. So he says this is the foundation, this is the superstructure, this, you know, sets the line, the other thing corresponds to it. So that same methodology, so to speak, to give it a fancy name, of seeing what's determining what and what follows from what, that same methodology that we've talked about him using with regard to production and distribution, it seems to me he's using the same procedure here in the preface to the contribution to the Critique of Political Economy. But thus far, nobody has, as far as I can see, addressed the second question in four: what kind of politics or kinds of politics underlie or flow from the criticism of economic determinism and the more developed and critical awareness?
Torev?
Yes, go ahead. Who's that?
Torev.
Yes, go ahead, Torev.
Yeah, exactly on part B. What I've written down earlier, what I had written down earlier, is that critics of Marx do not like the idea that things happen independently of consciousness. And this, and therefore the critics argue that Marx's conclusions, or conclusion, the one we're talking about here in question four, omits this, that, and the other. And omissions always limit the scope for decision-making and reality. And reality is never as simple as Marx concluded. And when these criticisms can be raised, then we can divert attention from production and the origin of surplus and all the conflicts that come with it. And if I may, I would also like to address part C of question four. What kind of politics flow from the criticism in connection with the more developed and critical awareness? Well, I think it is the philosophy of capitalism that every man is equal, as, and Marx has put this very bluntly in a quote. I think he was talking about a business tycoon at the time. I think his name was Jeremy Bentham. So Marx quotes, Marx says in that respect, the realm of freedom, equality, property, and Bentham. So he was talking about exchange where everybody is equal. So again, attention is diverted away from production. And as far as I'm aware, all mainstream economic theories everything other than Marx, considers production as a physical transformation of things, and consequently the workforce is treated like things. Over.
Andrew, I'd like to make a quick point on this, if I may. Anthony, it's Ravi.
Ravi, go ahead.
I think that the whole idea of being an economic determinist is counterposing the idea of objectivity to that of subjectivity. So in saying that Marx is an economic determinist, it's saying that it's almost as though there is no role for subjectivity in making history, and because of that, it's an automatic process of things just unfolding without any human intent shaping history itself. And obviously that's not what Marx is about, but in the same way that it's important not to counterpose one to the other, but to see them as a unity, and the subjective being a moment within the objective, and that's quite important, because rather than great men making history, it is the movement of masses that changes society in a fundamental way, and the most that great men in history do is possibly guide the way in which the masses respond or react to what's going on, but it is the masses that make history, and I think that whole kind of subject-object thing is that the bourgeois view of it is to say that the subject is all important. The caricature of Marx is to say that, well, it's the objective that's all important, whereas for Marx himself, it was the subjective in shaping the objective circumstances that was critical. So human beings and human agency was the subject-object relation in history, and I think that's really the balance to get on whether Marx was an economic determinist or not. He was it to an extent, but only the extent to which human beings do not consciously shape their environment to create a truly free and human society. Over.
Okay. Anybody want to get in?
Yeah, come train.
You've spoken under this point, train.
Am I okay?
Yeah. Anybody else?
Dave Beach.
Yeah, go ahead, Dave.
I was thinking about this in terms of the way that he leads up to this very short and promising sentence, then begins an era of social revolution. And if we look at this in terms of this relationship between consciousness and economic or historical conditions, then it seems to me that what Marx is saying is that we can't just choose the moment of revolution. The revolution isn't just a subjective event, and it isn't brought about by us wanting one or hoping for one or even working for one in our own lives. The revolution is the result of historical processes which are actually beyond the control of revolutionaries themselves. So politically, therefore, there's this sense that he's trying to portray here of the historical conditions of any kind of action, even revolutionary action. Over.
This is Brandon.
Yeah, go ahead, Brandon.
First thing that comes to mind, or that came to mind for me when I saw this last bit about what kind of politics, is just that, at least in my experience in when I was in school, the charge of Marx being an economic determinist was usually attached to an interpretation of society that was what maybe you call it like multi-causal, and they wanted to treat social phenomena as being the result of a great diversity of different types of competing identities and competing forces, and often was not made the claim that it wasn't eliminating economic factors wasn't trying to eliminate economic factors from analysis, but was wanting to put claimed that it was wanting to try to put the things that Marx was talking about on the same sort of category as the relations between sexes, between races, so we get kind of this reduction of different types of political and different types of social factors to sort of all these sort of
competing forces that sort of like billiard balls that all sort of collide into each other, and it seems to be part of like a more contemporary postmodern academic trend. And I also wonder if that that is somewhat paralleled by the fragmentation of the academy into so many different subfields, from political economy to politics, sociology, and economics, and from those things splitting onto these sort of subfields, and the inability of thought to think of things as to have sort of large scale theories that actually deal with the interrelations between things in terms of different that might see different social forces as having different types of effectivity on the social sphere, rather than being all equal in their ability to affect things the same way. Over.
Okay, Shane.
I just wanted to add to whoever spoke before I interrupted. And that's, it all goes back to the individual too for economic. That's the thing I think that sort of throws them. It's all right if there's a whole lot of isolated individuals and that all adds up to a demand curve, and the economy is sort of the accumulation of a whole lot of individual choices. But when you talk about, productive forces in the sense of, collective things and collective actions, so it's, if all individual soldiers decide to go off to war, that's all right. But if you start talking about mass movements and mass change, or the sum total of social relations and production, then somehow that's immediately cast as the society somehow determining everything that happens, rather than it all just being we're free because we're all individuals making choices that add up to the society, and that's the crucial, bourgeois economics. They still do have collective aspects as long as it's the sum total of individuals, and that's when they start to say, well, Marx is an economic determinist because there's some other force operating, the collective force operating over the heads of people, which is not what Marx was saying, but that's how they read it, I think.
Okay, I'll call on myself. As the kinds of politics that underlie or flow from the criticism of economic determinism and the more developing critical awareness concerning production and distribution, on the left, it seems to me, first of all, most of the left, including Marxists, don't like the general conclusion of Marx's, are embarrassed by it, and propose various alternatives to vitiate it. For instance, most famously, Louis Althusser, who says, well, the production relations are determining in the last instance, but the lonely hour of the last instance never comes. And the politics that's associated with that is the politics of will, volition. We can, intervene in the midst of what is without revolutionizing the mode of production and change things here and now. And this is very attractive to people whose politics are such that the idea of human liberation is some distant dream or entirely off the agenda. So it's a kind of, Althusser was basically a Maoist, and basically we're going to remake society here and now without the concern for any needed preconditions. And, we can redistribute income, we can redistribute wealth, we can do whatever, because people matter, and it's not just economics, and that, I think, is the general conception held by most of the left, certainly in the United States, but I think it's fairly common as well. So I would say that a desire to assert one's will and to believe that the assertion of will is going to change things is very, very integral to this viewing Marx as an economic determinist and the opposition to what he's saying. You know, and I call it political determinism. Okay, does anyone want to say anything finally before we move on to question five? Yeah, I guess we should cut off the thing, Will, to this issue, but we should move on because there are more questions. So I'm going to move to question five, which reads, Will, by the way, is the recording going?
Yep, it's back up.
Good. Question five reads, what argument, if any, does Marx make in support of his contention that, quote, present-day distribution is the only fair distribution on the basis of the present-day mode of production? This sort of begins the part one, section three of the Critique of the Gospel program. Who would like to speak on this point? Hey, who have we not heard from? We have not heard from Peter Glover, Sudeep, Stefan, who I know has a problem. Whose password, Strong?
Do you want me to? It's Peter Glover. Do you want me to say something about this one? Yeah.
Sure, if you choose to. Yeah, I don't want to twist your arm.
Okay. Well, I think that's a good... this is linked to the 1%, 99%, because obviously there are people who think that there is a fairer distribution that you can have under capitalism, and that, you know, there are these kind of billions or trillions that are accumulated in bank vaults, and if only we could liberate these huge amounts of money, we could start to transform society. So that's probably, I think, one of the critical... the critical dividing lines in the left, and I kind of think we're outnumbered. I think most people would agree with Mark, what Mark says there about present-day distribution is the only fair distribution on the present-day mode of production. But you know, we're clearly in a minority, because it's a very simplistic view, isn't it? To think, well, what then? Surely, if it is this. If banks are full, and the same way actually there were, I think in the 1930s too as well, there were these enormous, in inverted commas, cash piles accumulating. You know, it's just so easy to point to them and say, look, you know, surely, you know, even as a short-term measure, we can just liberate, in inverted commas, some of this money and put it to work. And I think that's a kind of an alluring prospect, and it really captures, you know, a lot of people maybe in unions, at the tops of unions and think tanks, and I think it's captured kind of the you know, people on the revolutionary left spectrum as well. So I think it's pretty much captured everybody. So, and it's a very important issue, I think. So that's my take on question five. Over.
Thank you. Anybody else?
Andrew, this is Seth. I'll take that.
Yeah, go ahead, Seth.
Well, I mean, Marx makes the point here that economic relations are not regulated by legal conceptions, but rather that legal conceptions flow from economic conceptions. And it's the same kind of point he makes in the preface to the Critique of Political Economy, that the economic structure is the real foundation on which arises a legal and political superstructure. He also makes the this is Marx, he also makes the point, although he says this in regard to the lower phase of communism, but I think it holds here too. He says that right can never be higher than the economic structure of society. Over.
Seth, would you care to expound on that last sentence?
Well, it's the same thing, right? I mean, he has this conception of the legal and the legal, the political, the cultural, they flow out of the economic structure of a given society. Over.
Okay, did I see Sudeep ring in?
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead, please.
Marx doesn't really say this, I think, but I would think that since in capitalism or in capitalist mode of production, we take land, labor, and capital as different factors of production, each of them get what they invest in. According to capitalism, that would be a very fair distribution because everyone gets what they, I mean, in the proportion that they put in, right? So I would think that is what he has in mind, even though Marx doesn't really say that in, very clearly. Over.
Andrew? Anne?
Yes, Anne.
Yeah, I think Sudeep is right. Well, I think everybody's right that's spoken on this, but I think Marx's point is that for capitalism to work, it has to work this way, right? It has to pay the workers the minimum, and that's fair for that system because otherwise the system collapses. You know, you can all starve because there's no more investment and no more jobs, blah blah blah. So that's sort of what he's talking about, I think, the only fair distribution on the basis of the present-day mode of production. Fair in quotes. But this is a very, very contemporary issue that, you know, Peter was talking about how it relates to the 1%, 99% view. Because what I'm seeing now on the internet, the various movements to raise the minimum wage and stuff, they've started to call it that they're for a fair wage. And this makes my hair stand on end, right? Because the whole concept of a fair wage is an oxymoron. I mean, capitalism lives on wage slavery, and slavery can never be fair. You're forced to work in order to live at some horrible job, and to think that any wage can compensate you for that, I think, really throws people, curtails people's vision of a better way of life. So it's like we're back in the SDP in the early part of the last century, and I don't like it. What can I say? But I think Marx is meaning that very literally. Was my point. Over.
Okay, anybody else?
Tolev?
Yes, go ahead, Tolev.
Well, I'm not 100% sure whether I've understood the theory behind it correctly, but I'd like to have a go. It is the competition between producers and customers which brings about an average market value. And because of that average, it is not the average value, it is not the individual labor times that matter, but it is the average labor time that matter, or the socially necessary. So the competition brings out the socially necessary. And this average is the only fair measure of entitlement. It's not the individual time that somebody spends that determines their entitlement for consumption, but it's the average that determines the entitlement. And because of the way capitalism functions, this average is the only fair way. Over.
Okay. Let me call on myself. Marx, you know, in the Critique of the Gospel program, does not really explain why he thinks the present day distribution is fair, except in the sense, I think Anne was quite right, he basically says distribution according to the actual amount of labor you do is not possible because we don't have the production relations of communism, the lower phase, and certainly from each according to their ability to each according to their needs is not possible because we don't have, you know, a lot of stuff. But Marx does make an argument in Capital, Volume 1, which the people who were putting together the Gotha program should have been aware of, and certainly, you know, the Eisenachers have probably read. This is on, it's basically, I'm going to just quote from Chapter 24 of Volume 1 of Capital. It's on page 731 if you have the Penguin edition, and Marx has led up to this. He says, the original transformation of money into capital, that means money that expanded itself, takes place in the most exact accordance with the economic laws of commodity production and with the rights of property derived from them. And so it's fair. Nevertheless, its result is that the product belongs to the capitalist and not to the worker. Okay, so that looks unfair, but the worker has been paid the full value of her labor power, her ability to work. You know, she hasn't been cheated. But she wasn't a party to it's not her product. She produces the product, but it doesn't belong to her because nothing, you know, belongs to her other than her own labor power. Okay, so then he says the product belongs to the capitalist, not to the worker. The value of this product includes a surplus value, which costs the worker labor, but the capitalist nothing, and which nonetheless becomes the legitimate property of the capitalist. The worker has retained his labor power. He can sell it anew if he finds another buyer. So, this is the conclusion of several pages of analysis where he does say that, you know, the exploitation rests on a basis of equal exchange and, you know, total respect for property rights and the rights of individuals. So I really think if one has a question as to why Marx considers this fair, one should definitely look at Chapter 24 of Volume 1. Okay, would anybody else like to address this question?
Andrew, I'd like to say something very briefly. It's Ravi.
Yeah, go ahead, Ravi.
I think that the section you directed to us to on estranged labour was very good on this as well, because I think that's in the Economic and Philosophical Manuscripts. Where he talks about the fact that the activity and the product of labour is ranged against the worker and becomes a power over him. And the harder the worker works, then the greater this power that dominates him in the form of his own product. And it's that estranged character of labour under capitalism that makes it coerced, and that it's an alienation of the sort of what should be the kind of self-expression activity of human life, that instead becomes an alien external power to the worker. And I think this is fairly key, that until you remove the conditions by which that alienated, in which labour is alienated, until you overcome that through consciously regulating production in a democratic fashion, then this is something that will always exist, which means you have to get rid of capitalism. itself. Over.
Would anybody else like to address this question?
Can I ask one question?
Peter.
I'm going to contradict myself, actually, but it's a book. Social wage has remained kind of pretty resistant, or strongly resistant, to it being lowered in the West. So it's kind of like, I know this is contradicts the idea that you have a fair distribution. So you know, would anyone like to kind of come in on that, maybe, and talk about that? I know maybe time's moving on, maybe it's all, maybe some of them might discuss it, but it's an interesting, you know, an interesting point, I think, maybe. Over.
This is Stephanie.
Did others have difficulty hearing Peter?
Yeah, I had trouble hearing. Couldn't hear all the words.
Can you repeat the question, Andrew, or come back to it?
I just asked whether people had trouble hearing Peter, because I did.
You did, too.
Yeah.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yes, better.
Speak
into the mic, yeah.
The social wage has remained pretty much resistant to it being lowered over the last period. So I'm kind of contradicting what I said earlier in terms of, you know, which I brought, no, I do agree with this, the fact that, you know, Marx has, talks about, you know, fair distribution. So, I mean, would anyone like to, maybe if not now, because time's moving on, but could this question perhaps be, you know, would someone like to write about it or answer it or disagree or whatever? Because I think it's an interesting point. Over.
Yeah, I think it's extremely interesting. I don't have any thoughts on it, and we're running out of time here. Is there any objection to moving on to question six? Okay. Vinyevskaya, whose conception of the critique of the Gotha program is new ground for organization, is the foundation of this class. She writes, this is chapter 11 of the Rose Luxemburg book, that Marxists keep quoting from each according to his ability to each according to his need, but, quote, never bothered to study what would be required to make that real, close quote. So, exactly what is the principle of distribution here? Second, why did Marx think it was a realistic or fair principle in the lower phase of communism? What is? C, according to Marx, what aspect or aspects of the higher phase of communism's mode of production would enable the principle to become real and, quote, fair in that phase? Who would like to address this question? Or any part of it?
Others, but time's running out, so if you want to
take
a step. Okay, you wrote, what is the principle of distribution to each according to his needs? Very good question. People don't like to have to be specific about that, right? They just want to be in the land of milk and honey, but that's what it would mean. It would mean you could have as much of you want as you want of the products of labor without any regard to how much of any work you do. That's what it would mean. So, you know, that raises a lot of questions of what we would need to have such a society. B asks, why didn't Marx think it was realistic or fair in the lower phase of communism and what is. Well, aside from the fact that, that we may not have the sufficient productive forces to produce everything that everybody wants immediately upon leaving capitalism, also people who were used to the way we work under capitalism would probably resent those who can but do not work and would not want them to be able to have as much as they want of everything. His view of the way to organize remuneration in the lower phase of communism, which I mentioned before, with these labor certificates representing the hours of work you put in, is seen as fair at that stage of the game, even though it's nothing like everybody can have whatever they want as much as they want. And in the CGP, where is this? Well, I don't know if I should read or not, but he describes this, and he says the same principle prevails. This is right after he's described that lower phase, that paragraph. What we have to deal with here is a communist society, not as it's developed on its own foundations, but as it emerges from capitalist society. We talked a little bit about this last week. And then he says, here obviously the same principle prevails as that which regulates exchange of commodities as far as this is exchange of equal values. All right? Now, don't get him wrong here. This is completely different from capitalism because we're not talking about value production. We're talking about just the number of hours of work, not what some abstract concept of value they produce. But he says here, content and form are changed because under the altered circumstances, no one can give anything except his labor, and because, on the other hand, nothing can pass into the ownership of individuals, except individual means of consumption. But as far as distribution of the latter among the individual producers is concerned, the same principle prevails as in the exchange of commodity equivalents. So much labor in one form is exchanged for an equal amount of labor in another form. And then he says equal right here is still in principle bourgeois right, although principle and practice are no longer in conflict. In other words, in counter-capitalism they talk about rights, but they don't practice them. And now something is everything is completely different. I'll stop here because I'm talking too much and let someone else take a seat. Over.
Okay, anybody else?
Andrew, it's Paul.
Who do they hear?
Paul.
Paul, go ahead.
Yeah, I just, this issue of the principle from each according to his ability, to each according to his need, it seems to me that part of the reason it's so difficult to envision this is because we're so used to thinking of the satisfaction of needs in capitalist commodified form as sort of, you know, wow, I mean, we can have anything we want. We're just, you know, liable to get into this overconsumption sort of thing. And you know, how great is that and how utopian or idealistic is that? It seems to me this is tied into the conversation last week about the fact that what we're talking about is a stage of society in which labor itself, because it is no longer alienated, becomes a prime want. People are spending far more time engaged in non-alienated productive activity. And, you know, this business of to each according to his need is sort of secondary. Obviously, we're still going to need stuff, but that takes sort of, you know, the back burner in life, because labor itself has become unalienated, whereas today, of course, we're in a situation where everybody thinks of labor as, you know, the means to the end of consumption, which is why it's so difficult for people to understand that, you know, that passage and its notion of what life would be like under communism. Over.
This is Stephanie. I have just a quick technical question. It has to do with hearing. It seems like the quality of sound consistently is deteriorated, and I'm wondering if somebody's forgetting to mute their mic when they're not speaking. And then I do have something quick to add, unless we're out of time. Over.
Now go ahead, Stephanie. Please, everybody, check that you've muted your microphone, and go ahead, Stephanie.
Okay, so I don't remember where I read this, but I'm pretty sure it was just in the readings, because I've been reading ahead, of course, because I'm developing the questions for next session. But I'm pretty sure I read this in the stuff that was assigned for session two, Mark talking about the lower, I don't know if he was addressing the lower phase of communism or not, but he was talking about, Mark was talking about the problems when material, what people need is being distributed, there are going to be environmental, circumstantially related to where one lives, differences. If you live on the side of the mountain where there's water in a valley, getting your water from above, and you are able to grow your crops, blah, 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 you don't have to worry about where your water comes from and how much water you're consuming, maybe. And then people on the other side of the mountain who don't have water, or people who live in the plains versus the mountains, there are going to be some distribution issues around where one lives and what one is able to get from your immediate or surrounding environment vis-a-vis, you know, where you live, literally. Anyway, I'll stop there because I'm meandering now and I can't remember exactly what I wanted to say, but that's the gist of it, and that would create some differences also beyond the fact of who can produce so much in a given period of time, who is the most productive worker, blah, blah. Over.
Andrew, it's Ravi. Can I come in this briefly?
Yeah, go ahead, Ravi.
I think that one of the distinctions that Marx is making between the lower and higher phases of communism is that straight away, even in the lower phase of communism, labour is no longer alienated in that sense. It's no longer coerced, but it's there to meet social need, and it doesn't confront man as an alien power. However, the kind of transition from the lower to the higher phase is one where scarcity, I think Anne was talking about this, where scarcity has been overcome and that the productive forces have been sufficiently developed for everyone's needs to be met without a problem of restricting people to what they're allocated. And I think that's the essential difference, that straight away labour becomes free and it's freely associated labour, even in the lower phase of communism. But by the time you reach the higher phase, the scarcity has been overcome and all the problems of distribution are then also dealt with. Over.
Okay, I'd like to call myself with regard to C. And I think that I want to just put together everything because Marx mentioned a number of aspects, a number of conditions that are needed from each according to their ability, to each according to their need, to become real. He says, only under these conditions can the narrow horizon of bourgeois rights be
across the entire. So several of the conditions have to do with ending the division of labor, including the antithesis between mental and physical labor. And that has to do with the all-around development of the individual. So individuals have to become fully developed. And then we've got also the thing that's been mentioned. Labor has not only become a means of life to get what you want, but life's prime want. And in my translation, it does say want instead of necessity. So work becomes something that people want to do because it's not subject to the division of labor. It's part of an all-round developed individual. So that makes possible from each according to their ability. Without that, we're not going to have people giving from each according to their ability. And I would also like to note that Marx does not say anything about people's consciousness and, you know, not being greedy or inquisitive or individualistic. That comes in with Lenin. It's not here in this paragraph. So there's the first part, giving, you know, without regard to what you get, from each according to their ability, and then to each according to their needs. As Anne said, I mean, you know, the idea is that you get without regard to how much you give, and that requires the greater productivity, the increase in productive forces, partly made possible by this all-round development of the individual, and all of the springs of cooperative wealth flowing more abundantly. So we need a massive increase in productivity to make that possible. And these are then the aspects that would enable, from each according to their ability, to each according to their needs. The concept that precedes all of this is the one that Seth mentioned, is that right can never be higher than the economic structure of society and its cultural development conditioned thereby. So that is what makes this right or just or fair. That's what would enable, you know, legal rights to be in consonance with this. It's all about material and social and individual development. Okay, would anybody else like to address this question? You'll probably be the last comment because we're a little bit over. Yeah, who?
Dave, I've got a short comment.
Yes, Dave.
I just noticed that the that from each according to their ability to each according to their needs is a principle of distribution, but it's not about the distribution of wealth. In fact, it's closer to, if you look at the point made in question 7, vulgar socialism and the Democrats and bourgeois economists treat distribution as independent of the mode of production, whereas from each according to his ability to each according to his needs links production and distribution into one unified social system. So there's a kind of revolutionization, if you like, of the whole question of distribution, I think. Over.
Okay. We are slightly over. It's 5 minutes past the hour. If anybody's dying to say something, go entertain that. Otherwise, we'll call it a day.
Andrew, what about question 7?
You want to try question 7?
If people stay 5 minutes, I think we want to say something about organization, because that's what this whole class series is about, something more than we have.
Okay. Do people have objections to another 5 minutes? Okay.
Okay, hearing no objection. Anne, would you like to speak on this question?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm going to speak in shorthand, but surely this is where we're going with all this is, you know, what is the role of a Marxist organization? And we need to tie that, I think, to this question of production versus distribution a little more tightly. Obviously, we think that the role of an organization is not to advocate redistribution and hold out the illusion that capitalism can really give all the workers of the world a decent wage, whatever that is, a much higher wage and much more goods and enough money so they don't have to work, because then capitalism would be committing suicide. So we don't want to advocate those things and lie to the workers and all that. So that tells me what's not the role of an organization. But we need to discuss a lot more what is the role of a Marxist organization, besides teaching Marx and what he really said, which is a very good thing to do. But it's not the end all and the be all. And Marx says, you know, why are we retrogressing? This is the very end of section 3. After the real position has been made clear, in other words, after he's finished volume 1 of Capital and published it, and now the French edition and all that, why are we going backwards? Everything he describes just so much resonates with what's going on today in the left, where people are going for the easy, supposedly easy fix of redistribution as if it were possible. So why is that? You know, that's what we need to grapple with. Why does this question of political will that Andrew was discussing and others, you know, that we can just, I don't know, vote people in or change the climate of the country or something and decide to do things differently and they'll get done. Why is that so popular? Well, I think it's popular with organizations because organizations want to take power or have influence. And so they want some method whereby they can do it. And so they come up with these easy simplistic answers and untrue answers, and they mislead people because they're hoping that it will somehow put them in a position of power where politics can rule over economic conditions. So I'm opening up that discussion awful late today, but I'm sure we're going to come back to that. Over.
I've got a quick question, Andrew.
Ravi, go ahead.
On in Dinesh Guy's Rosa Luxemburg book, on page 156, she talks about the fact that the great transformation in Lenin, both on philosophy and revolutionary education of proletariat, did not extend to Lenin's concept of the party. And she says that his views on that remain essentially the same as they were in 1903, when he wrote What Is to Be Done. Now, she kind of counterposes that to Marx's critique of the Gotha program. I'm not quite clear that I've just reread What Is to Be Done, and I don't see that there is. I mean, some of his conclusions are very specific to the period of working in Tsarist Russia, where the socialists were outlawed and, you know, even trade unionism was made very difficult. But I don't see a counterposition as legitimate between What Is to Be Done, even, and in terms of its grounding and the separation between sort of politics and economics, and economic questions not being, sorry, the kind of trade unionism and the
mass organisations of the working class not being an appropriate forum in which to develop revolutionary theory, which he calls social democracy. I'm not quite sure what Dinesh Gaya's critique is here in counterposing Lenin to Marx. If you'd like to say something on that, please. Thanks.
Well, this is rather far afield from question seven, although it's related, but everything's related to everything, and it is over time. And so I suggest that we continue discussing it by email this week, or it might be appropriate for the next session, or certainly classes 5 and 6, which are on the relationship between the critique of the Gotha program and organization more specifically. Does anybody have anything really quick to say about question 7?
I do.
And I is Brian. Okay, go ahead, Brian.
So I think one of the big points with vulgar socialism and this obsession with distribution is that when you have that as your goal, you're no longer participating in an emancipatory project. You're just trying to give a little more to people. And in terms of organization, what that will result in is just kind of a mindless obsession with, you know, fundraising or activism without really understanding what the long-term consequences are going to be. So it just comes about, you know, bread and butter issues like living wage. And I think from that, you know, they lose their credibility as a revolutionary organization. That's it.
This is Stephanie.
Go ahead, Stephanie.
Real quick, I want to say I'm cool with this coming up, you know, because I think, well, I think we all think the same way, that everything is interrelated. So if it comes up and we want, people have mulled over this and they actually want to speak about it next week as part of the discussion, I'm fine with that. And over.
Okay, well, I'll say a word about question 7. Well, the real reason we did what you, Marx, called retrogress is because we're being practical, and the role of an organization is to intervene concretely, practically, in the political situation the way it is. And, you know, your theory, your critique, that's all well and good, but that's just theory, and we're being practical, and you can call it retrogression, but that's not what organization is all about. So I think that's the answer to his question.
Hey, John, just a really quick point.
And you want to be not on the recording?
Yeah, if that's okay.
Do people want to continue with this, or should we call it a day because it's now 16 after?
Could we on another session this particular question?
I cannot hear you, Peter. I mean, I heard you say something, but I can't hear what it is.
He said, can we put it on another session, this question?
Yeah, sure. So maybe we can think about giving it some special time. It would help if Peter, the other Peter, were to put it in writing, and then everybody can have access to it. I mean, it's fairly clear to me, but, you know, maybe in a week it won't be. So,
yeah.
Good. So, can we call it a day?
Have we been sent out a breakdown of what each session is going to be covering? I'm not sure I got that. Or did I?
Yes, in the initial story, and I think that there were materials sent to each person, but it's a story with sober senses. There is a whole syllabus giving the title of each of the classes and the readings for each of the classes.
Okay.
Yes, it was also sent to you in an email October 26th. Still there on the website.
Just to interject here, is it all right if I stop the recording at this point?
Yes, let me say it's been a great session. We'll see you next week, and you can stop, Will. But let's see if anyone has anything to say.